Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions of authors who you'd love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Andrew Witt to talk about his book Formulations. Andrew is an associate professor in practice at Harvard University Graduate School of Design and co-founder of Certain Measures, a studio working at the intersection of architecture and science. Andrew, thank you for being here with me today and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
So before we begin, can you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so my background actually before getting into architecture was in mathematics and philosophy. I did a little bit of work on the history of architecture. And then after getting a professional degree in architecture, I did a lot of work actually around digital design, applying computational and software tools to make very complex buildings possible. For the last few years, a partner and I have developed this new practice, Certain Measures, that applies some of those ideas to kind of like reconceive how design might be practiced.
Interesting. And so you kind of answered this a little bit in the background you just gave us. But the first question I had was, you know, I don't say this often, but when looking through the book, it has some of the coolest illustrations and graphics I've ever seen. And so, you know, I guess I'd wonder if you could elaborate for us a little more. What drew you to this facet of architecture that I personally don't see a lot of people showing much enthusiasm for?
Yeah, well, one of the things that shaped a lot of my thinking over the last few years was beginning to understand how digital tools were transforming the practice of design, and really how those tools became a way to access knowledge and technique and processes and ways of making form that just weren't possible before. And so really what I wanted to unpack was, you know, first of all, those kinds of changes and transformations, were they something that were entirely new, or was there some sort of history to this process of architecture or of architects engaging with mathematical and scientific processes to create form? And so the book is really about that kind of history, a kind of like prehistory of digital design, where architects were engaging with exactly those kinds of questions. They were looking at mathematical forms, they were looking at mathematical processes, they were looking at mathematical techniques, and trying to understand how those things could be productively and creatively applied to the discipline of architecture.
And so, you know, I think that I think yours is going to get a lot more of the bigger question, the vague ones, than maybe other interviews. And so the question I had for you, and we did talk about this briefly before we started. So what, I understand it might be tough to kind of summarize this, but what are you trying to tell us with your book? I think it's an interesting message.
Yeah, so basically what I'm trying to say is that there's a history of people who experimented with mathematical technique that went back, you know, at least a century and arguably much further. And that way of experimenting with mathematical ideas and forms and processes is something that tells us a lot about the transformation of practice today in connection with digital tools. And it also has a lot to say about sort of how architecture interacts with other disciplines. I think, you know, people think of architecture as a discipline, which is, you know, it's part art, part science, and sort of like interacts with a whole range of other other kinds of fields. And in fact, I wanted to understand at a little bit more basic level what that meant. What does it mean for architecture to interact with science? What does it mean for architecture to sort of like take on the tools of science or the tools of geometry or the tools of mathematics?
And so it's very interesting. I said, I think I made it clear just, you know, how fascinated I am by a lot of this. And so I think one thing, and, you know, maybe it, I apologize if this is getting a little off topic, but you had mentioned, you know, that your firm kind of talks about it, this is what your firm specializes in. And so I was wondering if you could tell the viewers and myself, because I am interested, maybe what that looks like. What kind of project are you taking on? How does that work?
Yeah, so one thing that my partner, Tobias Nolte, and I were interested in doing when we first began certain measures a few years ago was to take those processes of almost a kind of like scientific approach to design, and also especially the process of building software and creating tools, and thinking about those as kind of like an integral part of the design process, not something that's sort of like secondary and incidental, but actually a core part of the creative process of design. And so what we've done is develop this practice, certain measures, which takes on a range of different kinds of projects, some kind of like at a cultural level in the context of art and museum spaces, and some sort of in the space of design where we're designing sort of like buildings or environments or sort of experiences of the future. And, you know, basically fusing art and science in one practice. That's the project of certain measures.
And so it's interesting that you mentioned the intersection of art and science. You know, I, again, there's quite a bit of when I was going through the book that surprised me. I would never have thought in an architecture book I'd see a Max Ernst painting. For those who aren't familiar, a very famous surrealist artist. And so could you tell us a little bit, and I know that's not the only artist that shows up. Again, I do know that architecture is considered kind of art, but I don't think many people kind of literally look at it as this art form. And again, maybe this is with the science background. And so hopefully this question makes sense. Could you talk to us a little bit more about this idea of integrating art into architecture?
Yeah. So, I mean, I could talk about it also specifically in the context of the book. I mean, the Max Ernst example is, yeah, that's a really interesting example for me, because basically the etching that you're referring to is this sort of collage of the Venus de Milo and this sort of mathematical surface. And what's interesting about that collage is that basically Ernst's way of working was taking all sorts of catalogs of sort of like, you know, classical statuary, catalogs of mathematical surfaces, catalogs of every description, and beginning to sort of like splice those things together to create new kinds of forms. And as it turns out, the mathematical surfaces that he used, the catalog that he used, was the same catalog that Le Corbusier was looking at when he was thinking about projects like the Phillips Pavilion. So if anyone's familiar with the Phillips Pavilion, it's this very kind of like well-known project of Le Corbusier and Yannis Xenakis that used ideas of mathematical surfaces to develop a kind of pavilion for light and sound, a kind of like experiential media-based pavilion. And what was interesting is that, you know, these books of mathematical surfaces were circulating among artists, among architects, among a whole range of basically like the creative class of the mid 20th century. And they became this kind of like partial inspiration for certain new approaches to form and geometry and space.
And so, and thank you very much for explaining that. And so you're taught, you know, a little while back, you had mentioned that there's a bit of prehistory and some historical background in the book. And one thing that I found very interesting was, again, I don't want to keep coming back to the drawings, but there's a lot of technical drawings, and there's even quite a bit of the book dedicated to speaking about, you know, stereographic drawing tools. I'm going to butcher this, you know, the theodolite, the JT rule. Did I get it? And there's quite a few drawing machines that are taught. And I guess, again, I personally have not talked to anyone who went into depth about the actual drawing tools themselves. And so could you maybe explain to us a little bit why that was so important?
Yeah. So, you know, drawing machines for me are this kind of like precursor for the digital design tools that we use as a matter of course today. But one of the things that's key about them is that they sort of like packaged up various ways of working with geometry in a way that the operator didn't have to know a lot of technical details. Basically, if you have the drawing machine, you can create amazing things just by knowing how to use the drawing machine, but not necessarily knowing the mathematics underlying that. And so there's actually this very long and kind of an interesting and rich history of architects accessing very complex geometric processes through drawing machines, and actually a history of architects developing their own drawing machines to access some of those drawing techniques. So, like,
and that's a very interesting point. And I think what I was getting at, and you went there without me even having to goad you, is there is a debate that comes up a lot about this whole idea of parametric software. You know, the idea that a lot of us can draw and model very complicated things, and some might argue that maybe we're modeling and drawing things that we don't have a full understanding or design background in. And so, I mean, do you see a correlation there between the idea of architects creating a drawing machine and that's just evolving now, or do you think that these are unrelated?
Yeah. So in the last chapter of the book, the sort of conclusion of the book, I look at this sort of relationship between expertise and sort of like what I call dilettantism. So people just sort of like, doing exactly what you say, sort of like accessing forms without necessarily understanding process. But in the context of the book, actually, I think I take a kind of generous approach to that practice, because actually I think part of the interest of the book is understanding how those things, which are kind of foreign to architecture, those sort of like scientific techniques, how they enter into architecture. And often the first way that happens is by somebody in an enterprising and adaptive and sort of naive way, taking some of those forms and just sort of like putting them into a composition or putting them into the idea of sort of a building. And that kind of naivete, in a way, is actually an important part of the way that architecture begins to interact with other disciplines. So, you know, although there is this kind of, there are limitations to that kind of process, there are limitations to kind of like not understanding what's going on within the black box, there's also a kind of value in it. And I think it's actually the first step in, potentially a kind of like rich cross-disciplinarity.
Well, that's an interesting opinion, and thank you for kind of walking us through that. And so, you know, as I hinted at before we started, you know, math has never been my strong suit, and I think there's a lot of architects that might follow that opinion. And so there is one mathematical concept that does seem to show up quite a bit in the book, and thankfully due to YouTube, I'm actually familiar with it. And so the idea of topology, you know, I guess without turning this into a quiz, I mean, could you walk our viewers through that idea and how you tie it into the book and its relevance?
Yeah, so topology has, there are a couple of different aspects of topology, but one of the kind of like maybe most familiar visually is this way of understanding sort of like twisted or distorted or transformed surfaces, things like the Mobius strip, this strip which actually only has one side, or the Klein bottle. Topology is this way of kind of creating a system for understanding very complex surfaces. And actually, you know, this, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, this became a really sort of like fertile area of architectural research, where you have people like UN Studio and others really thinking about what the, you know, how you apply topology to design spaces and organizations for buildings. But the book sort of also argues that interest in topology and architecture actually went to at least the 30s. And so I trace a little bit of a history of how those ideas of complex surfacial forms and topological conversation actually emerged decades earlier.
Interesting. And kind of going on to that, you know, in quite a bit in the book, you talk about the grid and the cube, and of course, I'm sure every architect knows why they're valuable. However, even though you talk about them a lot and you make very strong cases, you know, I don't think a single image is a grid or a cube, and so maybe that's a bit of a leading question. But could you kind of talk to us a little bit about the grid or the cube as a starting point, but then going off using mathematics and science?
Yeah, so actually there's a book devoted to cubic or sort of like voxelized geometry. And in that chapter, I mean, there are actually several images that are cubic in nature. But one of the things that I think is interesting about those images is that they're never only grids and they're never only cubes. The cubes or grids are always in conversation with some larger geometry. they're a way to kind of like represent the assembly of a building, or they're a way to kind of bound or demarcate complex geometries or forms. And that was one of the things that I think was very interesting about how architects thought about the cube and thought about sort of voxelized geometry in the past, or sort of like gridded geometry, is that it was always in negotiation with some architectural end. And, you know, often architects would actually expand on those architectural ends and begin to think of those systems as systems not just for thinking about single buildings or spaces, but actually ways of organizing entire societies and economies. So what's interesting about that chapter in particular is you have a number of architects, like, for example, Yona Friedman, or the sort of guys who are doing the cubic construction compendium, who are thinking about how the simple idea of a cube can become this way to regulate much larger systems. And I think that's also kind of like a microcosm in a way for mathematics, or sort of like a metaphor for mathematics in the ways that it's often used for architects as this way to access much larger systems that might span beyond the individual building.
Very interesting. And so, of course, we could stay here all day and I could quiz you on the thousands of mathematical concepts you have in here. But one question I'm always curious about is, so now that the book has kind of completed, and I know you are actually about to launch it, is that correct? It hasn't launched yet?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's out, it's published. We're going to have an official launch event soon, March 26th at the Center for Architecture in New York.
And for those of you listening, that date will have passed, unfortunately, by the time you hear this. But so now that the book has come out, though, I guess what is next? What project are you? Have you moved on? What is occupying your time now?
Yeah, so a lot of our work has been, you know, historically related to, you know, the application of technology in architecture, and more we're interested in how that technology shapes or transforms the home. And so we've been looking a lot, actually, at how at domestic robots, how robots are going to be a part of the home, how actually they're already kind of like a part of the home to some extent with things like Roombas and
I have a few.
Yeah, perfect. You already have a roboticized house. So it's interesting also that there's a bit of a prehistory to that idea of the robotic house. And so one of the projects that I'm getting into now is a kind of history of the robotic house, kind of in relationship to the smart home, but also in relationship to robots as a kind of industrial technology.
Interesting.
It should be very interesting.
It does sound very interesting. Maybe we could talk again in the future about that.
It'll be a few years before that's done, but yes.
No, it's not quick. Well, again, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. For those of you listening, again, there's a lot of images that you just aren't seeing when you hear us. So, but Andrew, thank you again for talking with me today.
Okay, sure. Yeah, thanks.
And for those of you listening, the book is Formulations by Andrew Witt. Thank you again for listening and have a great day.